Welcome in to the Towel Boys. I'm Tyler Bischoff. He is Mike Grimala over at runrebs.com. And today, talking Rashad Vaughn, as Adrian Wojnarowski reported that he is going to leave. Rashad Vaughn refuting that on Twitter himself. Also going to talk some Dave Rice and expectations for next season, what he needs to do to continue being UNLV's coach. But starting with Vaughn, so Vaughn saw the Woj bomb coming in on Twitter, and he quickly tried to defuse that. I don't know if he cut the right wire or not, because it seems like a lot of people are ignoring what Rashad Vaughn said himself on Twitter, because I've seen a lot of people just taking it as fact that he's
going. Well, because he didn't come out and say, no, the story's wrong, I'm staying. He just said, I haven't made up my mind yet, which is not a complete denial, I guess, of the story. I don't know. I feel like if you're a UNLV fan, don't you feel like this had to be coming at some point, sooner or later?
I mean, I feel like most people thought Vaughn was coming back.
Really?
Yeah, like, I don't know. Maybe I'm just comparing it to Chris Wood. Like, everybody thinks it's a foregone conclusion.
I think in comparison to Chris Wood, I think like 100% of people think Chris Wood is gone. I understand. Yeah, Rashad Vaughn is, maybe fans are more split on him, but I don't think that fans should be that surprised that news is coming out now about him leaving for the draft.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think people are surprised. I guess, I don't know. It was if either one's coming back, it was Rashad Vaughn. I don't know. I kind of thought he was. Not based on anything other than just, hey, people aren't all that excited about him going, and he fell after his injury to, like, early, mid-second round, according to Draft Express, so it's not quite as enticing. So I don't know. I kind of thought he was coming back. So I guess I was a little surprised.
Even though Rashad Vaughn told you before he even left high school that he was going to be a one-and-done player, and then he was the team's leading scorer, and he was the conference freshman of the year.
Here's the thing. How old is Rashad Vaughn?
I'd have to look
it
up.
Is he 19 yet? He's 18 or 19. Yeah. He's going to change his mind. He's probably changed his mind six times since January.
I can see the... a few people have asked me, you know, I've written, you know, since the season ended a few times that I think Rashad Vaughn will leave for the draft. And so people have asked me why I feel so strongly about that. And it's the fact that he has in the past, you know, on record said that he wants to be a one and done player. And then I didn't see anything this season that would sort of knock him off that path. I think the one thing that if you're a UNLV fan, you're hoping for is that being an 18-year-old kid, it would be a personal decision. Like, he went to college for a year, and he liked it so much that, you know, he wants to do it for another year. I think that's basically your only hope of bringing him back for another year.
Yeah,
I'm not buying that another year is going to help his defense so much that it's going to rocket him, like, into the first round. I mean, if the NBA drafted on defense, the boards would look a lot different than they do.
Yeah, I don't think another year helps him in terms of draft stock at all. The only way it does is if he were to play a year and not get hurt.
Yeah.
Like, if he didn't get hurt this year, there would be nothing he could do next year to make himself better, besides taking some astronomical leap and becoming the best player in college basketball. But, if I was in his position, I would go. Like, unless for whatever reason, like you said, I just loved college so much that I wanted to come back for another year, I would go. Has he ever said anything in terms of him being one and done about draft position?
I have to go back and read the story, but this is while he was still in Minnesota. This is before he even came to Finley Prep. There's a story, I've linked to it a few times, where he lays out his plan. You know, he wanted to do prep school for a year at a top-notch national-type high school program. Then he wanted to do 1 year of college at a system where he could be, you know, like a focal point, and then he was off to the NBA. I mean, that's been the plan. I don't know how much draft position factors into that, but I will say that most players seem to believe in themselves when it comes to that. They tend to believe that once the NBA folks get a load of them, like they're gonna climb the charts, and that that part will take care of itself.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I don't know the exact money for second round, but I know like late first round is when you get to the $1 million, $900,000 range in terms of what you get paid. Obviously, that's he was kind of, wasn't he like 22nd, 23rd before the injury in terms of like where Draft Express had him and stuff?
He peaked right around like the mid-20s. Chris Wood was low 20s. I think he may have even gotten up into the high teens. But Vaughn, I think, peaked at around like 23 or 24.
Yeah, and now he's down at 40-something.
Yeah, late 40s. I think 48 when I checked after he declared, after the story came out about him declaring.
Yeah, so, I don't know, to me, like, that would make a big difference, first off, just because it's money, but a lot. I would venture to guess 99% of athletes that are as good as Rashad Vaughn think that they are as good as possible and are going to impress everybody once they get the chance. But I don't know. I know I asked you this. We talked about it right after Rashad Vaughn got hurt and whether we thought that made him more or less likely to go pro.
In the end, I don't think it's going to matter that much. I probably, after he had gotten hurt, I was going to say about a month ago, I did talk to an NBA scout, and he said that like that particular injury is not that worrisome. That's something that the NBA in general believes that guys can bounce back from, and it's not really a long-term concern. I guess the red flag is that he's had the same injury on both knees, but it's not like he's had it's not like he's re-injured the same knee again or had the same injury again. So I think that in the end, that those injury concerns are not going to amount to much as long as he goes through the combine stuff and the pre-draft stuff and proves that he's healthy.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people arguing like, oh, he needs to come back and be healthy for a year, or what if the best argument I saw on Twitter, I've seen it from two different people saying, what if he goes pro and gets hurt, then he'll never get that big contract in my process. Well, he gets one contract, whereas if he comes back and gets hurt, he might not ever get an NBA contract.
Yeah. No, the other argument I've seen is that you look at Ken Burch and look at Roscoe Smith, who both left eligibility on the table last year, and now they're, you know, in the D-League, you know, fighting to make rosters. But my counter to that is Rashad Vaughn is a completely different type of prospect. And then he may get drafted in the same range as those guys. He may be a late-round draft pick. He may be he may come into training camp with the same draft status as those guys, but he's not the same type of prospect. He's not the type of guy he's an upside guy, so he's not going to be the type of player that gets one training camp to prove himself that he deserves a job in the league. He's going to be a guy that if the team drafts him, they know that, you know, he's a freshman, he's young, they're going to put a couple years into developing him. You know, he's a development project. He's not a guy like Roscoe Smith who you draft and then you draft him, you know, based on his hustle and his production, and you hope that, you know, he can carve out a role somewhere at the end of the bench. Like Vaughn is if you draft him, you're putting some capital into him to develop him.
What's his biggest issue going to the NBA offensively?
Athleticism. I don't think he's like the type of super athlete that plays on the perimeter in the NBA. Like, I think he's got the shot. He may need to quicken some things up, but tighten up the ball handling. But he's a pretty good ball handler. He's got a pretty savvy off the dribble game, as we saw this year. He's pretty creative with the ball in his hands. I'd say athleticism is probably the biggest knock on him, and that's probably why he's not ranked higher. He's not a super athlete who's going to test really well when it comes to like jumping and running and all those types of tests.
He didn't have he had a fine shooting percentage, but didn't have a great shooting percentage. But he took a lot of high percentage shots. Like, he didn't take many long twos, took a lot of shots in the paint, shots from three. But I kind of figured that was because when Rashad Vaughn drives, he gets to about 4 or 5 feet, and he'd rather put up a floater or try to shoot from there rather than attack the rim and try to dunk on somebody or get a layup. And it's sort of like, you know, you see point guards with sort of the same philosophy. They get in the paint, they put up a floater because they don't want their shot to get blocked. That's the trade-off. You don't get your shot blocked when you put it up from 5 feet, but you don't get to the free throw line and you shoot a little bit worse percentage than if you would have gone straight to the rim. To me, that's the thing that always kind of, I won't say bothered, but as far as Rashad Vaughn, like, I thought he could have been a more efficient player if he had gone straight to the rim. I don't see him doing that once he goes pro, but I think he would be a much better player if he made that a habit.
I actually think that kind of speaks to the athleticism point. I don't know if he's an above-the-rim finisher. Yeah. Like, I don't think that's his game. which is a question he'll have to answer to any team that's interested in drafting him. Like, I don't see him driving down the lane, taking like a power dribble, and then just like jumping and finishing over people. That hasn't really been his game. We saw him more often, you know, drive through the lane, and then it's jump in the air and sort of swing the ball around and maneuver it around two guys or scoop it in between two defenders. Like, his finishes had to be creative because he's just not playing that above the rim game.
He tweeted he hasn't made a decision. I think Taylor Byrne talked to his dad, and his dad said the same thing, that they hadn't made a decision yet. Going back to Adrian Wojnarowski, who, if you don't know, he's the guy that will tweet out the 19th pick in the NBA draft while TV's still on the 16th pick. Who's his source that's close to Rashad Vaughn?
I'm gonna guess. He said it was a league source. I'm not.
Did he say it was a league source?
I thought that's what the terminology was in the story, that it was a league source. But okay. I mean, I'm gonna. Talking to NBA people throughout the season, I'm guessing, I don't want to like guess, I don't want to try and guess, try and tell you who his sources are, guess, you know, where it's coming from, but talking to NBA people, I think we can say that NBA people believe that Rashad Vaughn is gone. Like, that's what they would tell you all year long. And Chris Wood too. So when you talked, I would say that a league source is probably someone who's talk to them through the process, or I don't even know, I don't think it's legal to talk to these recruits yet, but someone who's, you know, they're facts for the Vaughns are like fact finding, they're doing research, they want to like sort of figure out where he slots in, that kind of stuff. So I'm guessing that league sources is probably people on that end who are getting the sense that he's, you know, he has made up his mind, although he hasn't announced it yet. He has made up his mind, and now he's, you know, trying to clean up on that end, and now they're relaying it to the media.
I hate anonymous sources. Like, that's one of the worst things about sports journalism. Does that happen in any other aspect of journalism, the rampant anonymous sourcing?
No, but...
Like, aren't you taught, like, you're not supposed to really give anonymity to a source unless it's an extreme case, right?
Yes.
Like, that's what I learned in journalism.
I mean, if we're talking all the president's men, and it's like you're talking about issues of national security, and you're going to bring down a presidency, then yes, like in the anonymous sources, that, you know, that's something you want to be careful with. But I mean, I'm also of the belief that we're covering sports here. I don't have a problem with if you can go overboard with the anonymous sources, but in an
Wojnarowski does, like, he's great because of it, but I wonder how many stories he's written that he doesn't have an anonymous source.
It's a lot of this stuff. It's hard to, you can't get someone to go on the record about this because it's, but then on the other hand, it's like, what's the harm in the long run?
Yeah. Like in this,
which I know
scenario,
would make my journalism teachers cringe, but we're covering sports. We're not covering, you know, national affairs.
Like, in this specific scenario, what does Wojnarowski gain by putting this story out? Like, he is so far above, you know, early mid-second round guy from UNLV. Like, what does he gain by giving a guy anonymity to put out this, you know, literally five-sentence story about Rashad Vaughn going pro?
Well, when Rashad Vaughn does announce that he's going pro, that's just another brick in the wall for Woj.
His wall's finished. It's done. Like, he doesn't need any more bricks. He's got.
You think
it.
So? Do you think you get to the top by just getting there and being satisfied?
Well, no. It's not that he's satisfied. It's that he doesn't need to chase Rashad Vaughn.
Maybe it fell into his lap. Maybe he's having a conversation with an NBA GM or some executive, and says, "Hey, what have you heard about the draft?" And the guy said, "Oh, well, this guy's coming out, this guy's coming out, this guy's coming out." And then he throws it up online. I don't know.
All right. So enough with Wojnarowski. UNLV without Rashad Vaughn. I am sort of kind of amazed at you and Taylor Byrne, who both since the season have ended, projected Dwayne Morgan to start at small forward. Explain yourself.
I think that a lot of, I don't want to use the word politics, but Dwayne Morgan is a very high. He was the foundation of that recruiting class that they brought in. He committed a year before anyone else, basically. He helped them build that recruiting class with him and Rashad Vaughn and Good Luck Okonobo and McCaw and Cornish. Like, he was the leader of that group. I think if you're expecting someone like Derek Jones to come in and, like, challenge him right away, I mean, Morgan has – I would give him the inside track because he's been here for a season already. It wasn't a great season. It wasn't even a good season. But, I mean, he's been here for a year. I don't know if they would – it, obviously, we're still 6 months away from them even, you know, bouncing a ball for, at the start of the official start of practice. But after you watch the way that they rebounded this year, now they're going to lose Chris Wood. Do you want to play a third guard, or do you want to play a guy who's a little bit bigger? Not that Morgan is the world's greatest rebounder, but he gives you a little bit of size if you want to play him at the three. He can't shoot, but defensively he fits in there. He can defend threes. He can, you know, slide around the floor. I just think that right now he may have the inside track to that position. If you gun to my head, like, what do I think would be the best for the team, would probably be play Cornish there.
Yeah, that's what I agree with, mainly because I love offensive spacing, and I don't think you can get that with Dwayne Morgan at the three, because he can't shoot. Like, it's his shooting numbers were horrendous. And the best thing is, or the worst thing, I guess, he took so many two-point jump shots. Like, if you go on to Hoop Math and look at the numbers, I think it was like 50% of his shots were two-point jumpers, and he made like 20% of them. Like, just an awful shooting percentage, but that's what he shot all the time. Didn't make any of them. He actually, I think he only shot like 6, or only shot like 15 threes. He shot like 34% from three or something like that. So in a very tiny sample size, he actually didn't shoot terrible from three, but he just cannot shoot from 18, 17 feet. I, like, to me, it would kill the offense if he's your three man, just because he can't shoot. Like, envisioning what they're going to try to do next year with the guys that they have right now, like Pat McCaw off ball screens, maybe post-ups for Ben Carter sort of look like to be the things that the offense is going to be about. I don't know exactly what Seegers brings offensively yet, but all of, like, the post-double becomes so much easier if Dwayne Morgan's out there and can't knock down a three. Pat McCaw has a much more congested lane if they can slide a help guy. Like, to me, it just kills the offense if he's your three-man.
I can't disagree based on the Morgan that we saw this season. I don't know. I just feel like that going into the, to use the term inside track, like, he's been here a year. He's got that, not leadership quality, but he has that reputation. I think that, I don't know that they've, you know, guaranteed him a certain amount of playing time. Obviously they didn't, because he played the least of any of their eight rotation guys this year. But I don't know. I just have a hard time seeing him being such a huge recruit for the program and then coming in and being the eighth man his freshman year and then being the seventh or eighth man again his sophomore year.
I will say it will be good for him to get him out of the post, because I went and looked at his foul rate or foul percentage or whatever, and, like, all of his fouls came when he was guarding somebody in the post. Like, somebody's trying to back him down, he fouled. Like, he didn't foul a whole lot if he was defending on the perimeter or whatever. It was, this guy's trying to back me down, and I'm gonna foul him when he goes up to shoot or try to steal his dribble or whatever. So if they do, like, if he does play significant time on the wing compared to in the post, like, he'll be able to play longer stretches, and maybe we'll see, like we did the last few regular season games, him be a much better offensive player with more than five possessions that he gets a chance to show something. Because he won't foul. He led the Mountain West in fouls per 40 minutes. Like, it was he and David Collette, two freshmen, just fouled everybody last year. But I don't know. I'm not convinced that he would be a starter or good enough to start next year. It's not completely crazy to me, because when you start thinking about, well, who does he have to beat out, it's going to be new guys and Jordan Cornish, if you assume Rashad Vaughn is gone. So not completely crazy, but I don't know. I just was a little bit surprised you and Taylor Byrne, both of you guys, said he was going to start next year. But, oh well, it's March. Dave Rice, Where do we sit with Dave Rice right now? So he's not fired, at least for a year. Expectations. What does Dave Rice have to do next year to not get fired again?
Well, NCAA tournament, I feel like, is the lowest possible standard. Like, he's got, like, he has to make the NCAA tournament. Do you agree? Let's, if you want to go step by step. Well, let's start at small, like, Mountain West. Where do they have to finish in the Mountain West? Are we talking top two? Are we talking, does he have to top three? Does he have to win it?
You know, I don't necessarily think there's a you have to finish top blank.
Mm.
I think it's more of, like, you need to be in contention for the Mountain West title coming down to the last three, four games of the year and, you know, be a legitimate team. You know, next year if there's five good teams and five teams have a chance to win it in the last 2 weeks and they finish fourth, like, to me that's not the end of the world. And next year if there's only two good teams and they finish second, like, it's sort of the same thing to me. So I wouldn't so much say you have to finish blank, but you have to be in title contention coming down to the last 2 weeks.
If you're in contention to win the title with three games left, it's hard to finish like lower than second or third in the conference.
I agree. But I'm just saying, there's a scenario where you've got four teams that are, you know, 11-5 going into the last few weeks, and to me that would be fine if he's in the top four and tied for first and ends up finishing fourth. Like, that's not the end of the world to me.
I'm not completely sure that a third place finish in the Mountain West brings him back. Just considering how close it seemed this year, I'm not sure like third place is going to do it. It might, depending on, as you said, the record, the situation. Like if there's you know, another, like it was this year, another tie for first, and then they finish a game back of those two teams, like something like that, and then they, you know, show well in the conference tournament. I can see that doing the job, but I don't know. It's the language that Tina Kunze-Murphy used in her statement. What was it that about she wanted to Mountain West power? What did she say?
Yeah, it basically wanted the UNLV to be back as one of the top teams in the Mountain West. Mountain West. I don't know if she said Mountain West power, but basically along those mm-hmm. lines.
Okay.
So, and no, I get Mountain West power doesn't finish fourth in the conference, but I can foresee a scenario where you can finish fourth and still have a good year in the conference standings, and if you put some ultimatum of you have to finish top two, that would be kind of...
Obviously, it's not going to be as black and white in that. Here, included in those expectations are to reaffirm our status as a leader in the Mountain West and our position as a national program. So, a leader in the Mountain West. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I guess you want to say top three, top four, somewhere in... They have to contend for the title with let's say with you know 2 weeks left. They can't be out of the race. They've still got to be in it with a chance to win the title, and a team that's playing well at the end of the year and, you know, sort of, you believe, has a chance to win the conference title, regular season and tournament.
Yeah,
they got to
NCAA tournament. What do they have?
They
got to
make it. They got to make it lock stock, like no bubble. They've got to be in there. Or do you think they could sneak in as, you know, one of the last four teams in and get bounced in the first week? And do you think they have to, like, be a solid team? Or does it not matter as long as they're in?
I don't know. I think I would say it doesn't matter next year. Because, yes, you have these expectations of UNLV basketball returning to the early 90s. And so that's not, oh, you're the last team in, you've got to go play a game in Dayton just to make the field of 64. But at the same time, this team was not any good this year. And to me, you kind of have to balance those two things. Like, from what Tina said, like, they have expectations of being a Mountain West leader, being a national program. But at the same time, you were just 18-15, and you finished bottom half of the Mountain West, nowhere near the NCAA tournament. To me, like, I don't put the expectations of you have to go from that to a 7 seed or better. Like, to me, that's kind of outlandish, but I'm fine with saying you have to make the NCAA tournament. I'd even be fine if you said, you know, you've got to make it somewhat comfortably. You can't just be the last team in, get bounced in Dayton. That's not good enough. I'm sort of okay with that. I will say this, because I've heard people say, you know, the NCAA tournament's not good enough, and you've got to make a significant run. And I would have a problem, and I I'm pretty sure Tina's not putting any ultimatum, like you said. It's not as black and white on Dave Rice next year. But I would have a problem with really anybody, whether you're a fan, media, or if you're the athletic director, putting a ultimatum like you have to make the Sweet 16 next year. Because if you watch the NCAA tournament, it's ridiculous. And putting like a Sweet 16 ultimatum doesn't work. Because let me ask you this. Take Virginia's season. They were 28-2 in the regular season. Won the ACC regular season title. If UNLV went 28-2 next year, won the regular season title, got a 2 seed in the NCAA tournament, but then lost in their second game to a 7 seed. So they don't make the Sweet 16. Like, do you fire Dave Rice because you put down some ultimatum that he had to make the Sweet 16?
No, I think you're right. In a case like that, if they have a dominant season, then they, you know, have some of that bad NCAA tournament luck where they, or a bad matchup where they get bounced early. I think that's, they're good. Like that, the Virginia had a great season. Like they didn't. And then, that's a great season.
Take it the other way, and say UNLV does what UCLA did this year. They were 19-12 in the regular season. Nobody thought they should have been in. Say that happens. UNLV wins, you know, they're 19-12. They sneak their way in. Everybody's saying, no, Temple should have been in, not UNLV. And then UNLV goes and beats two teams. And they're in the Sweet 16 all of a sudden, and they were a 19-12 team. But you're like, oh, we put a Sweet 16 ultimatum. The season was disappointing, but hey, we won 2 games. And if you take UCLA's, they got a goaltending call to win their first game. They got to play a lower seed than them in the second game. They didn't exactly do anything super impressive to get to the Sweet 16. So to me, that's like, I'm fine if you say you have to make the NCAA tournament. Like, I'm fine with that as an ultimatum. I'm fine if saying, you know, you've got to be a comfortable team, a lock or whatever. That's okay. But to say you've got to reach a certain point is just ridiculous, because if you do it that way, UCLA had a better season than Virginia and Villanova, which is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. No, not so much saying that. So instead of saying, you know, you have to make the Sweet 16, what if the criteria is you have to be a Sweet 16 caliber team? Like a team that if you made the Sweet 16, it would not be a shock, or it would not be a Cinderella run for you to make the Sweet 16. What if like those the expectations?
Yeah, and I'd be fine with that. I still think for next year that's a little bit too high just because of where they were this past season. But I would be fine with that as sort of the ultimatum. Is like, you know, you've got to be a team that could legitimately get to the Sweet 16, and nobody would say, oh my God, what are they doing here?
And that would be a big jump. Like you said, is that to go from where they were this year to, you know, being one of the top 35 or so teams in the country next year with legitimate Sweet 16 hopes. And of course, like, we're doing this, we have no idea like what the roster is going to look like even at this point. But is that too big of a jump? Is that sort of setting him up to with expectations that he can't meet? Is that just giving him another a year to make it a less controversial decision if they want to let him go next offseason?
Yeah, I kind of think it would be the expectations are too high, and you sort of set them up to fail in a sense if you said, hey, you gotta win 2 games in the NCAA tournament, you gotta be in the Sweet 16 or you're done. But I don't know. And like you said, it's not gonna be that black and white for the actual decision next year, which I guess makes it a little bit harder. I mean, honestly, you know, the athletic department's job would be easier if they just said, all right, Sweet 16 and you're fired. And then they could just say, hey, we told him he's going Sweet 16 or he's fired. But I imagine we'll have a little bit of discussion. Because here's the thing. I've come to this theory with college coaches. The only fan bases that are like 90, 95% happy with their coach are fan bases that have a coach that have A, won a national title, or B, that head coach has taken their program to like its highest ever level. So if it's like a program that's never been any good and the coach took them to the Sweet 16, like fans are 90 to 95% happy with them. Otherwise, not happy. Your coach is going to want to be fired. People are going to want to fire your coach after every season because it's never going to be good enough. If Dave Rice makes the Sweet 16 next year and they lose a game at the buzzer, like, there are going to be people that say, Dave Rice can't get it done, never going to take this team to the final. Like, that's going to happen at the end of next year, even if they made the Sweet 16. Mm. So, I don't know. I'm convinced fan-wise that never going to be happy unless the coach wins a national title or, you know, takes a bad program to new heights. I don't ask you this. Where does Price fit in? Because Dave Rice is $700,000 a year. That's tied for fourth in the conference, so he's behind Steve Fisher, Larry Eustace, Neil at New Mexico. He's tied with Larry Shiat. But if you look at the NCAA tournament and you take the top 48 teams, so everybody that or is 46, everybody that wasn't in just because they're in a small conference and won the conference title game, but the real 46 teams in the conference, Dave Rice made more money than two coaches. Northern Iowa and Dayton are the only two programs that paid less money to their head coach and made the NCAA tournament than UNLV this year.
Which makes it – that's one of the things about that whole the whole saga that was sort of interesting is that they had apparently a group of boosters like had a hand-picked guy that they wanted to bring in and like they were going to pay this guy X amount of money and they're going to pay off Dave Rice's buyout and – so, like, that stuff matters. Like, I don't know if fans, like, in general understand, like, that the athletic department does run, like, on a budget. And it's sometimes their hands are tied and sometimes it's difficult for them to make moves. And then sometimes they have to reach out, like, outside the university to, you know, for boosters and things like that to sort of make things happen. Because they're not operating with, you know, unlimited resources.
I don't know where UNLV sits in, like, basketball only for, like, revenue and expenses and where they sit with that. I imagine they're far behind every P5 school. Is that fair to say? Do you think UNLV, in terms of basketball-only revenue and expenses, they're behind every Power 5 conference?
Probably.
I would imagine that's where they are. You're paying Dave Rice $700,000. I mean, Lon Kruger, the last coach here, is making triple what Dave Rice makes at Oklahoma. Oklahoma's got a similar basketball history. If you look at Sweet 16, NCAA tournament appearances, Final Four appearances, the only real difference is UNLV won a title, Oklahoma's lost in the title game twice. They've got, like, very similar overall history in basketball. Oklahoma's paying triple what UNLV's paying their head coach. And if you look at the NCAA tournament, I think, I can't remember the exact number, but it's 30-something coaches make $2 million that are in the NCAA tournament this year. So 30-something of the NCAA tournament coaches make triple what Dave Rice makes. Now, you know, he's the hometown guy. You know, he's said, or TKM said, money's not an issue. That's why he's only getting $700,000. But at some point, it's like you're expecting him to do what coaches that are getting paid three times his salary are expecting. Like that, like all the coaches in the Sweet 16, $2 million or more. Like, that's what it is, and that's sort of the expectation a lot of people have next year. And I don't know where it fits in, because UNLV, to me, like, money sets your long-term expectations. Like, if you don't have a lot of money, you can't expect for 10 years to be a powerhouse. But UNLV, I think, can play above their money expectations because they do have pretty good facilities, and they do have really good recruiting right now, and they do have that national title. They do have some history that they can lean on. But to me, it's and I don't know exactly where to fit Price into this, but to me, it's hard for me to say, like, you got to get rid of Dave Rice when you're only paying him $700,000.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this before. It's like, he, for the money that they're paying, like, that he's kind of a bargain. Like, for the results may not have been there the last 2 years in terms of, you know, everyone wants to make the postseason, but in terms of being nationally relevant, like the type of games that they're scheduling and the type of recruits that they're bringing in, like, UNLV is actually kind of like a player on the national scene, which is more than you can expect from because of the what you're paying the coach. But the fact that they're recruiting with all these blue blood schools, like they're pulling players away from away from Duke and away from Syracuse. Teams that they really should not be regularly recruiting against and beating. Like, they're beating those teams for really good players. They're upping the schedule. They're playing sort of a national schedule. They played Kansas last year. They played Arizona 2 years in a row. They've got Duke on the schedule. Like, they're kind of like trying to become a national program on a shoestring budget, especially when it comes to, like, the head coach's salary.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't think it I don't think the price sets anything in stone, but I do think it is a big factor because, you know, you're not going to get a Dave Rice level recruiter at $700,000 if you fire him. Like that's not happening. If they wanted to fire Dave Rice, pay the next coach, you're not bringing in this recruiting class for $700,000. Now, you might get a guy that can coach lesser talent to a higher level potentially, but $700,000 is not really going to cut it as a basketball coach if you want to be a top 25 team every year. One other thing, because Steven Zimmerman kind of said it. You talked, was it Derek Jones you talked to right after this?
Yeah.
Neither one of them said they paid much attention to the Dave Rice saga that lasted a whole 2 or 3 days. One, do you believe them? And two, one, do you believe them?
I believe Derek Jones, just because I was, the course of our conversation, he made it clear that like he was UNLV was his choice, and he even said something. I think he said something along the lines of like whether it was Rice or another guy, like UNLV had his heart and they had his all. So like he was set for UNLV no matter what. Zimmerman, I'm not so sure. Just because he's in Las Vegas, and obviously his mom is like a well-known UNLV fan, so like she's up on that kind of stuff all the time. So I can't imagine that like it didn't reach him. Like I'm sure he had some contact with some of the coaches like while that was going on.
There have been in terms of recruiting, UNLV was 18-15. And Dave Rice for two straight years has had issues with whether, he's coming back, leaving, whatever. And basically college basketball, college football recruiting is not a pretty thing. Like there is a ton of negative recruiting. And I imagine a lot of coaches are going to use that against UNLV. Like, hey, they sucked last year. Hey, Dave Rice almost got fired. You can go there. He's not even going to be there when you graduate or whatever. But I get, and it varies from player to player, but to me, I kind of start to think a lot of kids, they don't care a lot of times about certain situations. Like, and especially in Derek Jones's place, like you said, he committed to UNLV, not to a head coach. Like, if you had a kid that was set on going to a particular school and a coach came in and negatively recruited saying, hey, that coach isn't going to be there, like, I just imagine a player being like, I don't really care. Like, I think it's overplayed, the negative recruiting that would happen or how much it could hurt UNLV in recruiting, with Dave Rice's stuff being drawn out for two whole days or with a bad season.
Yeah, I mean, the relationships are important. It's probably the most important thing. But if you're recruiting a guy, you do want coaches, not just the head coach, but assistant coaches, the guys that are also going to be working with you like every day. You want to be comfortable with those guys. You want to sort of know what you're getting into. But even for guys who envision themselves not being, 4-year college students, like you're still spending, the next year of your life, the next 2 years of your life, on this campus and at this school. So like the school, to a certain extent, like does factor into it, And I'm sure the NCAA loved, Derek Jones's comment where he said, I'm committing to the school, I'm not really committing to the head coach, because that's what they're always advocating. That's what they say. That's what they always say whenever a letter of intent, a dispute comes up. They always say, well, you're not committing to the coach, you're committing to the school. So, yeah, obviously that is a huge factor.
All right, I got one football thing. I don't know if you paid attention to it, but UNLV and their ticket prices for next year for football.
I saw something. I didn't see the entire story, but I did see that they were or priority seating or something along those lines.
So basically, there's three sections, and I think they're the sections at midfield. Basically, they're going to require a $50 to $75 donation next year for season ticket holders to have those seats again. Somebody that I've never heard of, John L. Smith, wrote a column for the Las Vegas Review-Journal basically saying, like, UNLV football sucks. This is how they thank their fans, by requiring a donation to buy these tickets. But apparently there's 33 sections of seats in UNLV's football stadium. The other 30 sections, all of the ticket prices were lowered for next year. So a lot of people have already, said like, hey, I just bought my football season tickets because prices went down. And as far as the donation thing goes, $50 isn't a whole lot of money. Like, I don't know what the rest of the Mountain West is.
Mr. Moneybags, $50 is not a lot of money. That's 10 meals at McDonald's for me. That's 2 weeks worth of food.
Like, I don't know what the rest of the Mountain West does, but if you look around college football, and granted, UNLV's awful. Like, you win two games every year. But if you look around college football, like, if somebody said you got to pay $50 to get these seats, like, that would be that doesn't get you in the door at a lot of places. Like, even if you said, hey, I'll give you a $50 donation and pay for the tickets, like, they wouldn't even consider it because they're taking, they're taking in $5,000 donations just for the right to buy the seats at a lot of places. So the idea that people would be that upset with $50 more is kind of ridiculous.
I don't know. I can see it because of the product that they put on the field. Like, no one goes to those games. Like, those games are not, it's not an event. Like, it's not, people aren't lined up outside, like, trying to get in. So I feel like the demand is not really forcing the price raise, the raise in prices, or the mandatory donation. It's not really because of the demand for the tickets. It's just because, they want more money.
Do they do that for basketball? Do you know?
I'm not sure how they ticket for basketball.
God, they have to, right? Like, if they don't do that priority seating where you have to donate to the program to have the right to buy a certain ticket, they're just behind if they're not doing that for basketball, because there has, it wasn't so much this year, but there is demand for UNLV basketball tickets. So I don't, like, to me, you've got to do it in football. Start at $50 just so you have it. Like, you're falling behind if you don't. I'm pretty sure other Mountain West schools have it too. Like, you've got to do it just to have it so you can start that. And then, if Tony Sanchez is good and they do win some games and in 2 years they go to like a bowl game or something, you can say, okay, now you got to give us $200 to buy those tickets. And then it's like, okay, if they actually do get good in the future, like, okay, here's $1,000 and you can have those seats. So to me, they just have to do it just to do it, just to have them in there. But, oh well, I got one thing, because Mike, this weekend I'm doing play-by-play for baseball, softball. Eric Van Meetrens, UNLV's catcher, we're recording this before the game on Saturday. He's reached base in his last 18 plate appearances.
That's a pretty good streak.
It tied an NCAA record. In that 18 plate appearance streak, he's walked 7 times, was hit by 1 pitch. So he has 10 hits. 3 of them are home runs, 1's a triple, and 2 more are doubles. Like, he's on fire.
You can't beat 18 for 18 in baseball. Like, the main object of the game is to not make an out. So if you're getting on base 18 times in a row.
You say that, and I'm going to complain about Tim Chambers. In the 8th inning with UNLV down by 1, a man on first and nobody out, their catcher, Eric Van Meetrens, was at the plate. 1-1 count. The coach put on a sack bunt. He did. He pulled the bunt back, and I can't remember if it was a ball or a strike, but they took it off the next pitch. But I was just like, "What are you
now,
doing?"
I'm not a huge college baseball fan. I'm more of a pro baseball fan. But one thing I do know is that bunting a man from first base to second base lowers your run expectancy.
Yeah,
more than anything else you can do at the plate besides making it out.
It does in college baseball too. Like, it's the same process. They still sack bunt all the time because coaches are old and I don't know. They don't get the internet. I don't know. But it's incredibly stupid to sack bunt, like, in any situation. They still do it, and God, to do it, like, they had 6 outs left in the game. Needed a run. You've got a guy who's just as hot as possible and he shows bunt. It was bad. But yeah, sack bunting stupid. Like, they shouldn't do it. At all. You get 27 outs in a game. Don't give one away.
The only, not to, kind of off the rails on this being a UNLV basketball podcast, but the only time I'd ever sacrifice bunt is if you're a walk-off situation, runner on second, nobody out, and you want to bunt him to third so that you can, like, score him on a sack fly or a ground ball or something like that. Like,
and your number 9 hitter, who's your shortstop, yeah, who's hitting 192.
But even then, I wouldn't get upset about it, but I'd still rather let him swing away.
Yeah, but maybe if a guy has hit into like 6 straight double plays, at which point you should just pinch hit for him. But maybe if he's your you know you're in the 18th inning or something, yeah, maybe then you should let him bunt. But I don't know. It's you got anything that annoys you?
You know what? I do. I actually.
Okay.
I wouldn't have it. I wouldn't have had something, but I wasted a tweet on this. It was a couple weeks ago. I live in an apartment complex where there's a fitness center, which is sort of like a small gym. They have like 20 machines, treadmills and stuff like that. And if you sort of keep a schedule, you run into the same people who are also, you know, on the schedule. And the thing that really gets under my skin is when someone goes to the gym and instead of doing what a normal person would do and being considerate and plugging in their headphones and listening to their music that way, they feel the need to put it on speaker and blast it throughout the entire space because I don't want to listen to your music. Whatever you're listening to, I don't want to hear it.
But they want you to
exactly
hear.
Like they want you to hear what they're listening to. I don't know why. I could care less. All it's doing is making me angry. That like even do you know anyone that you know whether you're on a road trip or you know just driving in the car or you know hanging out. So do you know anyone that wants to listen to someone else's playlist? People want to control what they listen to. No one wants to hear even if you picked like the same 10 songs that I would have picked. I don't want to give up control of what I'm listening to. What I started doing is it's kind of childish, but when someone comes in and plays their music out loud, I'll put on my headphones and while I'm like running or you know doing whatever, I'll sing along to my music as loud as I can. I've done it a few times now, and a couple times it has driven the other person out of the room. But then one time it didn't, so I'm stuck there singing for, you know, 45 minutes. But that's what I do to combat it. But I don't understand why people, headphones are, in this day and age, headphones are plentiful, they're inexpensive. I get mine at Walmart, it's like $4.99. They last a couple of weeks until my dog chews them up, and then I buy another pair. It's not a big deal. You go out and you can get headphones pretty much anywhere. You can stop at a gas station, and when you get to the counter, they'll have headphones right there. As an impulse item that you can just pick up if you want to. I don't know who all these people. If you have an iPhone, if you're at the gym with an iPhone, I know that they put a pair of headphones in with that iPhone when you bought it. Plug them in, put them in your ears, and listen to it that way. I don't want to hear it.
Is it the same person every time?
It's the same person a few times. There's a couple people that do it.
Oh.
And one of the guys has external speakers that he puts in. It's like I don't know what it is. It's like a little round speaker that he plugs in so that he can play his music louder throughout the space.
You just need to move.
Ugh.
Although I do want to come watch you sing while you work
out. Yeah, it's not good. Like I'm out of breath. I'm sweating. But
because I can't like if I can't talk when I'm like doing something physical. Like if I'm running and running with somebody, I don't talk to them because I'm like I'm saving my breath to run. I'm not talking. It hurts me to do that. I couldn't sing and try to work out or anything.
Yeah, I'm not saying it sounds good. It's just the opposite. It probably sounds really bad. But if they're gonna ruin my experience, I'm gonna make their experience as difficult as possible too.
Like two people or three people? Like how many different
people? It's two people.
People.
One guy.
Are they ever in at the same time?
No, I've never seen them. They've never battled. You know, and then
okay.
One guy cranks it up to 8, and the next guy goes up to 9, and then the other guy goes.
Because
back.
That would actually be kind of entertaining.
That would be kind of fun. And one guy, you know, sort of listens to techno. This is like this EDM type of stuff, and then the other guy listens to mostly hip hop. So I don't know how well they would mesh.
And then you'd just be in the corner singing as loud
as
you can.
And that is what makes me angry.
This is the greatest gym story I've ever heard.
Yeah. It's not fun.
This is good. I do want to hear you sing, Mike.
Yeah. Well, I don't like going to the gym in the first place, and then then you just make it even worse. Like once I get there, and I don't know. If you're listening to this podcast, be considerate of other people. Be a human being, and think about what you're doing. Think about how your actions are affecting other people. As you're doing it. That's all I ask.
Do you think these people that play their music also back into parking spots?
Probably. I think if you were to do a Venn diagram, you'd find that there's a significant overlap between the type of people who do both things. These are specific examples of it, but my greatest pet peeve is probably people who are not considerate and just who are not self-aware of their surroundings and the impact that they're having on other people, which I kind of envy. If you can just live your life in a state of like obliviousness and you just like everything you do, you know, it doesn't even enter your mind. You don't even think about how it's affecting other people or whether people are looking at you or hating you. Like if you just go through life and you just have no idea, that's kind of like a blissful ignorance. Like I guess I could envy that.
You should. It would be pretty good. Just no clue what's going on with anybody else. Yeah, that sounds wonderful.
No, that's not me. If I'm holding up someone while I'm backing into a parking spot, that would make I would be really upset. I'd be like, oh man, I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm such an idiot. I'm never doing this again. I tried it once and it's going so badly that everyone is mad at me. I'm done with this. Like, that's how I would think. But these people, they just crank it into reverse every time, back it up. 10 minutes later, they're in their spot. Whatever.
Oh, this is great. This is good. I am glad I asked you. Glad I remembered to ask you. That was the best part of the podcast, Mike.
Oh, what's your starting five for UNLV next year?
Not Dwayne Morgan. Seegers, McCaw, Cornish. Wait, who do I think it's going to be, or who do I think the best? I'm doing best five. I don't care. I don't know who I think it's going to be. Best five is going to be Seegers, McCaw, Cornish, and then Carter starting inside, and Okonobo at least until Steven Zimmerman proves he's the best player in college basketball.
Mm-hmm. I get.
Does that?
I don't know how the front court is going to shake up, but I would. That's probably be my Seegers, McCaw, Cornish. If you ask for like my best. I think that would probably be the best lineup. You know, that kind of late to be throwing these stats out, but Jordan Cornish, three of UNLV's five most efficient lineups this year in terms of plus-minus, had Jordan Cornish playing shooting guard.
Because he shot 90%.
He did. He made all of his three-pointers. But I don't know.
Every single one of them.
I was not really expecting it. He didn't play a ton of like shooting guard this year, but he played enough to, yeah, like three of their five best lineups were him in the backcourt.
You know what's funny now that I'm kind of thinking about it? He hit a lot of big shots late in games in the second half of the year. But remember, what game was it? Was it the Colorado State game where he took the three at the end to try to win it?
He missed it. Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, and like I wrote about it, it was the first shot he had taken in the last minute of a game. And like everybody was like, why the hell is that going to Jordan Cornish? Why shouldn't somebody else be
shooting? Because that was the game where Rashad Vaughn had went off for 30-something, correct?
Yeah. No, he went off for 30. I thought he went off for 31 against San Diego State.
But that was a game where Rashad Vaughn was hot.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
he had a strong second half, and then he didn't touch the ball in the last possession.
Yeah, he kind of. Where was he? He was out of.
He's in the left corner.
Yeah, he was non-existent. Yeah. But oh well, still a good look. Still should have knocked it down. Oh well. Just think how different they would be playing today if he had hit that shot.
Well, next year when he's starting at the three. He'll have plenty of opportunity, I think, to hit more big shots.
Yeah, or, you know, Dwayne Morgan starting at three. Now, if Dwayne Morgan starts, he'll foul out in the first 10 minutes, and Cornish will have to play anyway.
You're talking freshman Dwayne Morgan. I'm projecting sophomore Dwayne Morgan, who's going to be
listen,
everything.
Coaches always,
everything people
coaches always say they take their biggest leap from year one to year
there
two, which I don't always believe. But, my God, if Pat McCall takes a huge leap, going to win the national championship with McCall averaging 50.
And Jordan Cornish, I mean, if he shot 48% from three this year, what do you think next year, like 60, 65%?
He's going to be averaging 2 points per shot. Yeah. He's going to start getting fouled on like 50% of his three-pointers. So he's going to set the NCAA record for and one three-pointers next
year.
That's
an efficient offense.
Yeah,
Dave Rice contract extension in season, if that happens.
In season, because they're putting up 200 points a game because Jordan Cornish can't miss and gets fouled on everything.
Yeah.
Okay, Mike, I wish you well in your endeavors at the gym. Actually, I don't, because I just really want you to sing more out loud at the gym and public places. Like that, that makes me happy.
I wish you luck in your baseball game today.
Yes, it's softball today.
Softball
today. Their baseball's on the radio, so they don't need me. They kick me out. I go do softball, which is okay because typical softball game is 2 hours. Typical baseball game is 3 hours, so I can leave and go watch the Elite.
So you do call the softball games?
Okay, yes.
Because I did tune into a UNLV softball game earlier this season. It didn't sound like you, but it might have been something else.
Well, okay, I only do the home games, first off, so some of their road games have been on the road. But I also missed two games one weekend, and I didn't, you know, if I'm doing baseball. I'm just explaining it to you how it works, Mike.
Okay.
There's baseball and softball at the same time. Baseball is a priority. I do baseball, unless baseball's on the radio, then I do softball.
Okay. That makes sense.
That makes sense. Does that work for you?
I gotcha.
Okay. Baseball team's only 12-12. Disappointing year. Oh, well. All right, Mike. This has been the Towel Boys. He's Mike Grimaldo over at RunRevs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff here at Mountain West Connection. Until next time Mike gets pissed off about something, that's when we'll schedule our podcast. Whenever Mike has something good to complain about, that's when we'll do it. Although I guess it's my turn next time. But this has been the Towel Boys. Thanks for tuning in.